America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just the cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Eighty years ago today, the violent explosion of a single atomic bomb deprived people said to number well more than 100,000 of their precious lives. Even those who escaped death suffered hardships beyond description. That's Prime Minister of Japan Shigeru Ishiba speaking at a memorial ceremony in Hiroshima, marking August 6, 1945, when the world's first atomic bomb dropped on the city. Mourners gathered to pay their respects, with the sentiments felt all the way across the world. As Japanese Americans find local ways to honor the tragedy, organizations here in Chicago are also commemorating the anniversary. So we put together a great panel for you. They'll walk us through how the aftermath of the bombings is being honored in our area. They'll dig into the intergenerational impact of such loss and how historic events like these have fueled activism within Chicago's Japanese community. At the table was John Donners, board president of the Japanese Art Foundation, Rebecca Ozaki, program director for the Japanese American Citizens League, Chicago, Jeannie Tomoda Harrell, who's also a program director for the JACL Chicago, and Yuki Miyamoto, professor of religious studies at DePaul University, joined us remotely from Hiroshima. Now, Yuki had been attending remembrance ceremonies in Hiroshima, and she started off by sharing how the city is marking this event.
You just play the recording of Prime Minister Ishiba, but this ceremony is organized by the city. So usually the main speaker is Hiroshima Mayor Matsui. Mm-hmm. Kazumi Matsui is the one who delivered a speech, and Mayor Matsui and Hiroshima Governor Yuzaki and PM Ishiba, all of them delivered a speech. But I could tell that given the current international climate, and also it has been 80 years, we don't have many hibakusha whom we are referring to as the people who have experienced the atomic bombings. You know, we don't have them forever, and it has been 80 years. So yeah. Those speakers are telling us that how we could carry their legacy, and this is an urgent and dire situation.
Yuki, how are you hearing people talk about the bombings today? What are the conversations like?
Well, part of the conversation is, as I said, how we can hand down this legacy and experiences, and how we can encourage the younger people to continue to work for anti-nuclear movement. And I myself was one of them, and I'm trying to talk about it and teach my students as well.
Mm-hmm. John, tell us about an event that's happening tonight here in Chicago.
Sure. So tonight in Chicago will be our third annual Toranegashi Festival, and that is the Japanese Lantern Festival focused all around honoring the 80th anniversary of the bombing, as well as honoring our ancestors and those who have passed away. It first started in Japan the year after the bombing, and then in Chicago, the Japanese Arts Foundation, in conjunction with the Japanese Culture Center and the Chicago Park District, started it about 3 years ago. And that first ceremony that we had was mostly the local Japanese American community and folks who had a personal connection to the bombing. And then in the following years, we opened it up more to the broader Chicago community to really bridge that connection between Chicago's Japanese American community and then the broader Chicago community.
Toro Nagashi. And Jeannie, the JACL is one of the groups that will be present at the Lantern Ceremony. Rebecca, you will be there. Tell us about what you do at the JACL, and I'd love to hear sort of what's top of mind for you entering into tonight's event.
Sure, yeah. So JACL Chicago was founded in 1945. It's actually our 80th anniversary as well this year. And we are part of the oldest Asian American civil rights organization in the country, JACL National. And our mission is really to secure and maintain the rights of Japanese Americans. But today, anyone who's experiencing bigotry or injustice, regardless of background, you know, ethnicity, anything. And our chapter specifically also focuses on like multicultural identity work, community
building. So there's an inclusivity there.
Yeah, yeah. Our community has become really multicultural, like Jeannie and I, even for example, I'm bi-ethnic and Jeannie's multicultural as well. And so as we pursue intersectional work and justice work, you know, it's really reflected in our community and those connections are pretty clear. So we're excited, or, you know, excited is probably not the right word, but we are honored to participate tonight. Mm-hmm. This is the first time JACL Chicago will be participating in the Lantern Festival. And I think for us, there's really, you know, JACL Chicago is rooted in the history of Japanese American incarceration. That's how we were founded. Out of support for folks who are resettling after the incarceration camps during World War II were closed. My family was part of that migration to Chicago as well.
Yeah, what is it like to be a descendant of that?
Yeah, it's great question. Something we talk about a lot in our organization is the intergenerational trauma that comes up as we explore what it means to be a descendant. My grandparents did, you know, to some degree and different degrees, talk about their experience as survivors of Japanese American incarceration. So I was able to hear on one side, you know, from my grandfather mostly those stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Jeannie, I mean, if you can just pick up where Rebecca left off there, particularly talking more about the types of discrimination that folks were facing back then and just what the Japanese American community was like back then when you all founded an organization like this in the 40s.
Sure. In Chicago, much of the reason we have a huge Japanese American or the size of Japanese American community that we have in Chicago, it's not as big as on certain coasts. A lot of that reason is because of post-World War II resettlement. Becky can speak a little bit more specifically to the problems that her family went through, but I do want to highlight a lot of employment discrimination, financial discrimination, not being able to get loans to take care of your family, to be able to feed them and afford housing. Just simple discrimination like that, that prevents you from settling in a new home that's far away from what you've already known.
Mm-hmm. Do the events from 80 years ago, you think, do they still loom large over the Japanese American community? Is that still a present thought in 2025?
I would say so. Yeah, Chicagoans or Japanese American Chicagoans have been coming, in World War II, after World War II, as Chicagoans, as Japanese Americans came to Chicago, they weren't allowed to. They were forbidden by the FBI to congregate, to set up, Japan towns or kind of concentrated business areas like that.
Right.
The goal, as far as the FBI was concerned, was for Japanese people to assimilate into a white status quo, basically. So there is a sense of that cultural erasure that Japanese Americans today are still fighting against and trying to reclaim that background.
Yeah. And you are all nodding at the table. Sounds like you agree.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, that is a part of the role that the Japanese Culture Center, our sister organization, fills, is being sort of a bit of an anchor to Chicago's historic Japantown, which is the Lakeview area. And then our nonprofit arm, the Arts Foundation, which I'm the head of, we then work to sort of mend that gap between then reaching broader Chicago and, you know, offering those opportunities to Japanese American community and then the Chicago community at large. And so that is an ongoing effort, as you mentioned, and there are efforts still even in the Lakeview community to make sure that it remains a space that is still recognized as Chicago's Japantown, and that that history is not only not erased, but that it is actually remembered, and that we proactively make efforts to continue that legacy of remembrance.
Yuki, what was your experience personally? You're a descendant of someone affected by the bomb. Tell us more.
Sure, sure. My mother was 6 years old at the time of the bombing. She was a mile away from the hypocenter. That's what I was told from my aunt. And my mother never told me about her experiences. And later that my aunt also told me that she was probably actually not at her place with her mother and her sister, which was a mile away. But she was my mother was probably at the elementary school, which was even closer to the hypocenter. And she, but you know, we don't know for sure. And then that school, hundreds of kids were killed instantly.
Yeah. Was your mother not sharing the stories with you?
Correct. And then I think it's because of she was afraid of me facing discrimination, and because. Especially women, you know, people expect women to bear healthy children or, you know, live long and support families. And sometimes hibakusha, they were, their health was fragile. And that's why they were often shunned as a partner. And I don't know much about her growing up, but in her 30s, as far as I remember, in her 30s, she had menial disease. And in her 40s, she was not able to produce healthy blood cells. So she had to get blood booster shots every other week. And in her 50s, she was diagnosed with cancer and she passed away at the age of 62, which was a long time ago already.
Yeah, but it strikes me to hear both you, Yuki, and you, Rebecca, talk about, you know, the your elders not sharing these stories. I understand in Yuki's case about the safety concern there, right? I'm not going to pass it down because I don't want you to kind of go through some of this. But there's an effect. There's an intergenerational impact that lingers. And I'd love to hear from you both on that. Yuki, you first.
Okay, sure. For example, my cousin, who was born after the bombing, I would say 9 years after the bombing, so she was not there at the time of the bombing, but then she had autoimmune disease in her 30s and almost bedridden for next 2 decades, and she passed away in her 50s, leaving 2 children behind. And I don't want to say that this was, you know, atomic bombing affect our, mutates our genes. I don't want to be decisive because the medical community has not proven yet if there is generational effects. But at the same time, I feel like, well, it seems like there are. I know some second generation kids, and some of them passed away from leukemia. But I also want to be careful. I don't want to produce any prejudice against them, including myself.
Right.
So I'm always kind of torn between. I feel like there is some kind of effect, influence, like generational influences, like physical. But at the same time, I also don't want to speak a lot about it. And so that's where I am.
Yeah, to your point, I mean, we may not fully have the data to support yet, but you're living it and you know what you're feeling, right? Talk about that, Rebecca.
Sure. So my grandparents were in high school when they were incarcerated, forced into America's concentration camps. And so my grandmother wouldn't talk to me about her story much growing up. And that's a common thing I've heard, you know, of folks who are in my generation and younger of that. They didn't get to hear that story, right? And, you know, we go back to why. For my grandmother, I found out not until I was almost an adult that her father passed away in the camps just months before they actually closed. So they were so close to quote unquote freedom and he could not ever escape. And so as an adult, I understand why she couldn't talk about that, right? For my grandfather, he as he got older, he was actually the first Asian American CPS principal in Chicago. So he used that platform to talk to students. Yeah. And I benefited from that, right? Because he would talk to me about the incarceration experience. So he talked about his, you know, just a month after Pearl Harbor being bombed, his father being taken away by FBI agents, like with a bunch of guns on them. He actually joined the 442, which was a all Japanese American infantry. And he said one of the main reasons he even did that was so that they could get his father back. So like all of these like little tidbits that we piece together have definitely trickled down into like what does shame or anger or even like mental health issues or alcoholism, like all these things, how do they show up in our community today? And a program that we run is called Intergenerational Conversations, which is exactly the point.
Sort of break that cycle. Yeah,
exactly.
I can see the emotion. You're holding it back, but I can see just as you talk about them.
Yeah.
You're still feeling that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was really close to them. And the fact that even every time I tell this story, I still get emotional because it's
I
can almost not fathom it happened.
John, let's talk more about that Toro Nagashi happening tonight. I mean, tell me more about how you're wrapping in the 80th anniversary and factoring in things, you know, as you plan this event.
Sure. So for this year, just as all the other years, we've always made sure to center it on the bombing, but we really tried to put together a very special program this year. And we have often had the Bulletin of Atomic Sciences be present. They will also be present as well, giving remarks on sort of the anniversary and then also what it means for where our world is at now in terms of nuclear proliferation. And we also will have present the grandson of Harry Truman, Clifton Truman Daniels, and his group, Flame of Hope. And they are an organization that's focused on decreasing nuclear proliferation and promoting peace and hope within not only the United States, but internationally. And the Consul General of Japan in Chicago will also be there. And so we really bring all these figures together so that we can tell this narrative of it being a learning point, not only just to, you know, honor those who have passed away, but to make sure that it didn't happen in vain, to make sure that we can prevent that from ever happening again, and to really show that U.S.-Japan connection, and then also show the effect on both the Japanese-American community and the Chicago community at large. And so it's a really beautiful,
all-encompassing, sounds very interesting. And Jeannie, it makes me think of just other ways that we can remember those that we lost, right? Members of the Japanese American community, because you know what they say about waiting for anniversaries for things like this, right? We got to kind of keep their memories alive throughout the year.
Of
so
course.
Talk about some other ways that we can do that.
Sure. I would say that right now in the Japanese American community, especially in Chicago, there is a big push towards activism, motivation to stand up for other marginalized groups. I would say that this is best encapsulated with the phrase never again is now, because Japanese American community has learned and seen firsthand how harmful mass incarceration is. These sudden detentions, mass incarceration is not where we're going to go. And we've also seen that it's not the answer, because no Japanese Americans who were incarcerated were found to be guilty of espionage like the FBI had suspected. So Japanese American families or the Japanese American community knows this story very well, and we don't want to see it repeated again. So right now, I would say that we're mobilizing our community to stand up for other marginalized groups, especially these days. You hear a lot about migrants being taken off the street without due process. Very scary stories, but they don't even have to be migrants. Just no due process, people taken off the street. That's something the Japanese American community is unfortunate to know firsthand.
Yeah.
So we're trying
to become allies.
Exactly. So we're trying to steward that history and also use that history as a springboard to stand up for other communities as well.
Yeah. Yuki, does Hiroshima also participate in the Toro Nagashi?
Yes, that has already happened, but it was beautiful.
Yeah.
I also just want to chime in a little bit about Japanese American history.
Because
approximately 4,000 Japanese Americans living in Hiroshima at the time of the bombing, and partly because Hiroshima was the prefecture that sent the largest migrants to the North America. However, their parents were not confident in their kids' future, especially after the Great Depression. So they sent back the kids to their parents, which are those Japanese Americans' grandparents. So they were in Hiroshima for that reason, and they were stuck in Japan after the Pearl Harbor.
How has discourse around nuclear arms changed over the years, Yuki?
In Japan or in the United States?
Both, if you've seen a difference.
Oh, both. Oh, okay, yeah, sure. On June 28th, the new Pew Research Forum published the new survey. And according to that, people who justify the nuclear attack, the atomic bombing in 1945, the number of who justified it was 35%, not justified, 31%, not sure, 33%, which was significantly lower when it comes to justifying the nuclear bombs in 1945. Mm-hmm. Only years ago, it was 56%. And of course, 1945, it was 85%. So it seems like people, especially among the youth, the age between 18 and 29, 44% people are thinking that it was unjustifiable.
Wow. Folks are nodding at the table. What's going through your mind, Rebecca?
Just the fact that during the war, you know, I think the United States framed it as this is wartime necessity. Like, we have no other option but to drop an atomic bomb, you know, on people. And the fact that that happened. Sorry, I think I'm getting a little bit emotional too.
Don't apologize.
And that, you know, it was approved. It's something that was approved. It was framed as something that is for our good, like to save America. Just that narrative in itself, I think, in many ways is resonating today. And that's why I'm feeling like passionate about this. But it makes sense that it's going down, right? Like, mm-hmm. Talking about war, not just here, but other, you know, with other places and other countries. And what is actually necessary for us at this time, you know, what does protection even mean? Mm-hmm. How are we even navigating that? Not cohesive thoughts, but I'm feeling what Yuki's saying.
Real thoughts, nonetheless. Yuki, what do you have to say here after hearing Rebecca's?
I feel the pains, and also it's interesting to think that people who answered not sure, women are more than almost a double scored than men, which I found it maybe women are a little bit more patient in not jumping into the conclusion or seeing the more complicated elements in this historical event. But I think I was using Malcolm Gladwell's new book, Revenge of a Tipping Point.
Yes.
I was from this book, he was saying like the voice of the number of minorities in any group or organization, institution exceeds the 30%, then their voice affects the decision making. And it seems to me that not justified 31%, justified 35%, not sure 33%, it seems like all 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to turn this into a tipping point.
Mm, yeah, and that Malcolm Gladwell book is a great one. So wonderful example there. When I look at you all at the table, I wonder, I'm thinking of Generation Z, what are they, Alpha, the ones after them?
Already.
Right. Is there an interest, you think, among the young Japanese Americans, like the super young, to learn what we're talking about? What do you think, John?
I think absolutely. We see it at the Culture Center and at the Arts Foundation, just in terms of how many folks who are of Gen Z and Gen Alpha who come out to these events and show a distinct interest in the events like Toranigashi. Because, like, for example, tonight we've totally sold out this event.
Wow.
As I'd mentioned before, when we first started it, it was around maybe a handful, like 20 to 30 folks from the community.
And now it's grown.
It's selling out. And many, I would say even as of last year, like almost half were, you know, of that younger cohort. And so I think that at this moment, especially especially as, you know, in the world, it seems a little more chaotic. And, you know, we hear more talks of, you know, nuclear weapons being in the news. And so it's good that, like, we have the younger generation aware of this and, like, using this point as a point of remembrance for, as you had mentioned, you know, never again, you know, starting now.
That definitely gives me hope. And I'm circling back to what Yuki said earlier about, like, you know, just making sure the stories live on. Jeannie, is that something that's front and center for you all at JACL?
Yes, absolutely. I would say we do feel a strong sense of responsibility towards the history and a sense of stewardship towards that history. I would say that Japanese Americans, we have a responsibility because our identities exist at an intersection of Japanese and American powers. We have a responsibility to question oppressive status quos, whether that's internal to our own families or on a more macro scale worldwide.
Mm-hmm. And Yuki, you are bringing students from DePaul, I hear, to Hiroshima. Is that right?
Yes, usually after the Thanksgiving break. So late November and December, so they don't have to suffer from this sweltering heat right now.
Right. But how do they react when they get to Hiroshima and they start to learn and see things and really understand the human loss that happened here?
Right. The great thing about this program is that we have this platform. In the fall, we have intensive sessions. And then winter break, we take a trip. And then in winter quarter, we reconvene and kind of wrap up or synthesize our theories and experiences together. Some students make art pieces. Mm-hmm. And even though I tell them what happened, I show some photos, pictures, drawings, and all those things before our departure for Japan, once they come to Hiroshima and go to the museum and see things, one of the students actually told me, wow, not just numbers, but those are actually actual people. Or when they saw a tricycle and they realized, oh, of course there were kids. You know, so like some kind of knowledge or theories matches the reality and started feeling more connected to this historical event.
Are you inspired by, Rebecca, the activism that seems to have been fueled within folks here now in Chicago?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, talking about young folks, JACL Chicago, or just in the Japanese-American community in general, there's a huge base of young folks who are like multi-ethnic, multicultural, who want to be part of these movements.
I mean, this generation is different. I'm a mom of two Gen Zers, and I see my daughter, who has sometimes nothing to do with some of these different fights and walks, and she's posting on her social media, stop Asian hate, this and that. I love to see it.
Yeah.
It's an outspokenness that didn't exist in my time. I think when we were young, we kind of stayed away from that. Some of us barely watched the news. I'm surprised I got into this line of work. But I think that's got to be inspiring for folks like you who are sort of in the trenches of this and seeing others, the interest from others who aren't even part of the community.
Absolutely. Yeah. Actually, I took my 3-year-old to his first protest too. So I hear you.
You
on
did,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we do have a program that we run. We've been running it for 15 years. It's a pilgrimage for young Japanese Americans to visit an incarceration site. So kind of similar, you know, to what was being said about visiting Hiroshima.
Yeah.
And while we were there this summer, it was the same time as, you know, ICE raids happening. There were protests happening in LA. That's where we were following our visit to Manzanar National Historic Site. And so that's also the same time President Trump deployed the National Guard. So we were there this week, that same weekend, just a few blocks from where all of this was happening, and also sitting right across the street from where, for example, my family was forced to get on a bus and be detained. So it all just kind of happened at the same moment. And from there, the young folks that were involved, you know, really wanted to get involved further and go deeper into their activism, whether through understanding the carceral system, what's happening with immigration, knowing that the same things have happened to us.
I would add that young Japanese Americans, young Japanese people who are politically minded are not just interested in learning from the history. They're also interested in healing intergenerational trauma, healing these toxic cycles, whether they exist inside of our own families or in the world at large.
You know, and to that end, Yuki, I wonder, is there a fear, as you're teaching and you're passing these stories on, attending these ceremonies, is there a fear at all that these stories and the lessons will eventually be lost to time? Is that possible if we keep doing the work that we're doing here?
Oh, yeah, that's a very good question. I think I can feel that people are concerned, very much concerned about losing the history, this part of the history. But I have witnessed the young people are taking over and working together with Hibakusha. And also, it doesn't have to be anyone who was anyone who is in Hiroshima or who is in Japan. My students who have been working on this, and they have done a great work. So I'm usually very pessimistic, but when it comes to my students and the younger generation, yeah, I'm hopeful.
Yeah, we'll leave it there. Yuki Miyamoto is professor of religious studies at DePaul, calling us from Hiroshima. John Donners is board president of the Japanese Art Foundation. Rebecca Ozaki is program director of the JACL Chicago. And Jeannie Tomoda Harrell is also a program director. Thank you all so much. Great discussion.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Sienna Greaves and William Balk, mixed by Sienna and edited by Dan Tucker. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll meet again soon.